Well, hello and welcome to another episode of the Everyday Theology Podcast, where we as ordinary pastors connect theological truths to everyday believers like you and me. My name's Ben Campbell. I'm joined by Dustin Walters, and we have a guest with us today from Welch College, and his name is Matthew Stephen Bracey. Mr. Bracey, thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me, and let me just say that I really admire what you guys are doing through this podcast. And I appreciate both of you. I count you as friends.
Well, thank you for that comment. Today, we're going to talk about a book that was released by Welch Press entitled Secularism and the American Republic. Before we do that, I would like for our listeners to get to know you a little bit. Tell us some interesting fun facts about yourself and your ministry there, as well as your family.
Sure. I'm married to Sarah. We've been married going on 12 years. She's from Indiana originally. I'm from the Middle Tennessee area. I work at Welch College. I just finished my 10th year, and I work as the vice provost for academic administration. I'm an assistant professor for theology and culture. I have my law degree, so it's a bit of a hodgepodge. I do a little bit of everything. I teach in the areas of theology and philosophy and law, and I just love it. I don't think of myself as just sort of a guy who's interested only in the life of the mind. I enjoy fitness. I enjoy exercise. You know, I enjoy the country life. The smaller the town, the better. You know, just put me on a back porch, you know, with a grill and some meat. I'll go to town. So,
come on, don't tempt me with a good time. That's the way to go. I think it's good. Yeah. And Mr. Bracey has always kind of just been the culture guy. He's like the conglomeration of everything, it seems like. But let's talk about this book a little bit. Specifically, before we get into like the meat of the conversation and the meat of the content of the book, I want you maybe to speak a little bit, if you can, to kind of the background of this book and the why of this book. Because I know like Mr. Forlines was such a Renaissance theologian and a Renaissance scholar. I mean, he had his hand in like dipped in every different sphere of culture. And so maybe kind of the how and the why, but maybe also how like you got involved being the editor of the book and kind of the guy that puts it out.
Good question. I first was approached about this project in 2012, so quite a while ago. At the time, Mr. Forlines had been working on this project on secularism for a decade or so. He got onto the project because, you know, his whole life, practically, or it seemed that he just read all kinds of things that's talked about the United States of America being a secular nation, being founded on a secularist foundation. And arguments mounted in favor of this argument included arguments concerning the Establishment Clause, that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion from the First Amendment of our Constitution. So that's there in the background. He's reading along one day, and he reads that a guy named George Jacob Holyoake did not even coin the term secularism until the approximately 1850 or so, the mid-1800s. And he immediately thought, how could the United States be founded on secularism if secularism isn't even around yet? He initially thought, surely secularism is around at the time of the founding. It just goes by a different name. That's what he originally theorized was the answer to his question. But as he dug and as he dug and as he dug, he found out this was much more complicated and nuanced a question than he originally thought. So this then sent him on a journey that, I mean, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say it consumed the last two decades of his life. And this book here is about 300 pages, and this represents about half of the work he did, approximately half of the research he did. And so in the not too distant future, I'm not saying next year or anything, but in the not too distant future, a second volume of his research into secularism will come out. But the point is that initial question of was the United States founded on secularism just really drove him there at the end. And something I think that he illustrates in his example is he believes that theology and critical thinking is for life. You know, it's not just about systematic theology. As important as systematic theology is, it's about the ways in which thinking systematically and theologically applies to all of life, including history, including politics, including constitutional interpretation and all the rest.
One of the things that stands out to me, Matt, about this book, first of all, I was intrigued by the title, Secularism. And then secondly, once I got a copy of this book, the endorsements that you guys were able to retain on this book. I mean, there's names like Mike Huckabee. There's names like Garrett Ward Sheldon, who actually served at University of Virginia, and he wrote a book called The Political Philosophy of Thomas Jefferson. And since I read Forlines' work here in Secularism, I've encountered so many things about Jeffersonian politics. Can you tell us what in the world people generally mean when they say Jeffersonian agrarian politics? What does that mean? Define Jeffersonian politics for us and Forlines' take on it.
That's a big question. Thank you for asking it. In some ways, what a given person means by Jeffersonian politics, Jeffersonian democracy, you got to go to that author to see exactly what they mean, because Jefferson is such a big figure. He did so much writing. You know, he was involved in public life for over half a century, and his ideas reach into all kinds of things. So it kind of depends. What I would say, if I were to try to put a definition on it, you know, at the founding, there's debate about what exactly this nation is going to be, what it's going to look like, what politics is going to look like, and on and on. And one of those debates is between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. It's not exactly the same thing as our debates today, but there's an analogy that you can draw. The Federalists believed in a stronger federal government, and the Anti-Federalists believed in a stronger state governments, you know, in terms of the balance there. And you have both of those things in the early Republic. You know, George Washington, our first president, he's neither Federalist nor Anti-Federalist, although I think that his ideas lean a little bit more Federalist. John Adams, president number two, is a Federalist, but then Thomas Jefferson, president number three, is an Anti-Federalist. So that stuff is there. You know, in some ways, the Constitution proper is a product of the Federalists. And then our Bill of Rights is a product of the Anti-Federalists. So it's both there. What is Jeffersonian democracy and Jeffersonian politics? Well, in part, it's the belief that the people of a given locality ought to have the right to determine how that community is going to live their lives. So hypothetically, the people of Tennessee, if they so choose, can do life differently and do politics differently and do society differently than the people in Arkansas, than the people in California, than the people in Alaska. We don't all have to be carbon copies of the other. That's actually a good thing. And then in terms of economic things, you mentioned the agrarian part. You know, the South is very agrarian as we go forward in United States history. The North is very industrial as we go forward in United States history. Industry comes to be in the South eventually, but there's a real agrarian flavor to the character of Jefferson's democracy. One other thing I would say, you have Andrew Jackson. Jacksonian democracy comes a little bit later. And so you would also distinguish Jeffersonian democracy from Jacksonian democracy. As it relates to Forlines, I think that was the last thing you mentioned. As it relates to Forlines, part of Forlines' argument, our nation was founded with the idea that different groups of people could be different religiously. The problem with the secularists is it's as if they want everyone to be, well, a secularist. We are a secularist nation. And if you're going to be different than that, you can do that in your private houses of worship. But in public, you've got to be a secularist. That's kind of the idea. And so Mr. Forlons's point is that's not what the founders envisioned. The founders envisioned that we could be religiously who we are, not just in the privacy of our homes or the privacy of our meeting houses, but in public. And that we need to learn, though we're different, we need to learn to accommodate one another. So he talks a lot about accommodationism.
Yeah, so maybe for those who don't have quite a bit of knowledge of constitutionalism, secularism, economics, government, law, all of those things, maybe just explain a little bit. I think this might be helpful for some of our listeners. Maybe kind of give just a brief, 30,000 foot view of the difference between Federalists and Anti-Federalists. When it comes to especially like the founding of the country, and then maybe a two part to this, a second part to that is, what in the world does Forlons have any concern with this? What's the big deal about Forlons having the concern with these types of issues?
Federalists, as I said, I think if I'm trying to be as broad as possible, Federalists believe very much in the power of the federal government being over the power of state governments. There is what's called the Supremacy Clause in the Constitution. I'll not get sidetracked on that. I think there are ways in which that's misinterpreted. But Federalists, in modern day nomenclature, believe in a strong federal government. Alexander Hamilton is an example of a Federalist.
Sure.
Anti-Federalist says, yes, the federal government has its place, but only in a limited circumstance. And that the rest of it goes to the people, to the people of the state. An important clause in the Constitution for the Anti-Federalist is the 10th Amendment, which says that powers not reserved to the federal government go to the states. And if not to the states, then to the people. So unless the Constitution has specifically, I interpret that to mean, unless the Constitution has specifically prescribed a given power to the federal government, it doesn't have any business being in that. Otherwise, it's reserved to the states. Now, if you read that list of powers in the Constitution, you'll quickly discover that today the federal government has its hands in all kinds of things that aren't listed in the Constitution. So that's, I think, the 30,000 foot view difference. Basically, do you believe in a strong federal government, or do you not believe in a strong federal government?
For sure.
Does the federal government have the right to tell you how you're going to live your life, so on and so forth? The reason that Mr. Forlons is interested in this is because Mr. Forlons, he's passed away, but he's a Christian. He was a Christian. He's a Christian, and as a Christian, you think about this question of your voice being silenced. You think about this question of whether persecution of a sort is coming your way. I don't mean persecution in the way that we think about it, in other places in the world, but just in terms of, there's even people out there who talk in terms of basic Christian Orthodox belief is hate speech that has no role in the public square. And so certain people of a certain political persuasion talk rather strongly in this kind of language. And this is the reason why Mr. Forlons is interested. In other words, if the federal government says you Christians don't have a voice, is that something they can legitimately do? Or is that something that we as Christians should legitimately just accept? Or do we need to, there's a phrase in sort of theological literature, renewal through retrieval. Do we need to renew ourselves by retrieving something we've lost? Have we lost something important here? So this relates not simply to questions of free exercise of religion. It relates even more fundamentally just to the question of free speech. Someone said free speech in a society means the freedom to say something that somebody else doesn't like, or it means the ability of somebody to say something that you don't like and you don't want to cancel them for it.
That's excellent. And even as we think about, 2024 is right around the corner, we have another presidential election coming up. And one of the challenges that I find in the local church people ask questions about why should they even vote? Why does their voice matter? And they think that perhaps their vote will not be counted or their vote won't matter. But one of the things that relates to this book and what you're talking about now is Four Lines really emphasizes that Jefferson did not erect a strict wall of separation between the church or the religion and the public square. He actually, Four Lines repeatedly in the book, and this is one of the things that resonated with me as I've reviewed this and thought about this book, was Four Lines talked a lot about reasonable accommodation. Tell us a little bit more about what in the world is reasonable accommodation, and how is that different than this, quote, strict wall of separation that some secularists have advocated?
Through the history of the United States, through most of the history of the United States, there's been a religious flavor to much of the politics that's gone on. Example, you have, through our history, the Bible being read in public school. You have prayer being offered in public school. You have things like the Ten Commandments being put on government property. If you go to DC and you go to the Supreme Court building, lots of people are there, including, you ready, Moses. You know, this stuff is just right there throughout our history. Progressivism began to gain momentum in the 20th century, so that by the mid-1900s, secularism is really making a push. And in the mid-1900s, I would say, you have a series of cases in which Supreme Court justices are saying, this is unconstitutional, that's unconstitutional, this is unconstitutional. And they're looking at all kinds of things. One of the things they're looking at is the relationship between Christianity or religion in general, and public education. So there's this series of cases in the 1947, 1948, in which the Supreme Court justices say that there's supposed to be a strict separation between church and state, a strict separation between church and state. And they get that phrase, or they're inspired, that phrase is inspired by something Thomas Jefferson said way back in the early 1800s, in which he said the First Amendment has erected a wall of separation between church and state. They interpret that to be strict separation between church and state, meaning that you can't be bringing Christianity or religion more generally into the public school. There's a strict wall of separation. Here's the problem. If that's what Jefferson meant in the early 1800s, then why did we not do strict separation for more than 150 years, basically? In other words, that's not what Jefferson meant. That is not what Jefferson meant. What Jefferson meant was, it was simply what the Establishment Clause means. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. What does that mean? It means that England has the Church of England. We, as in America, shall not have the Church of the United States. That's all that it means. Unless you're doing that, you're not violating the Establishment Clause. Rather, what Thomas Jefferson advocated for was what Four Lines calls reasonable accommodation. That's actually the word accommodation is actually a word from Jefferson. We live in a nation with a lot of people with a lot of different ideas, and if we're going to learn to live together in community, we have to learn to accommodate one another. And we have to learn how to live in community, even though we are different, in the public square. And we see this in his own example. You mentioned one of our endorsers being at the University of Virginia, being the Thomas Jefferson guy at the University of Virginia. The University of Virginia is a college that, so this is public education. This is a college that Thomas Jefferson himself founded. And you know what he did at his at the college he founded? He accommodated religion. And so Mr. Four Lines gives all kinds of examples of accommodating religion. So we need to learn to accommodate one another.
Yeah, exactly. And so this goes into so many other things that we could get into. I think maybe a way to sort of bring the conversation down sort of to everyday practical levels here. I'll maybe speak, if you can, speak to this question that I'm about to ask from Fourline's perspective. But then maybe even your own perspective here, because like you've got the training just as much as anybody, with your Juris Doctorate. How is it then that Christians ought to accommodate? Like, where do we draw the line between go therefore and make disciples, but also religious freedom? Like, where is that involvement for Christians in the public square, for everyday believers, for just people in general who are just, farmers or bankers or whatever in local churches, pastors, deacons, laymen, whatever?
The example, to speak first from Mr. Fourline's perspective, the example he gives and the analogy that he uses the analogy of a table. He says that in a lot of places, Christians aren't even given a seat at the table. And people of other religions, too. They're not the only people who are invited to the table to have a conversation about whatever the topic happens to be are people who are irreligious, people who are secularists. And so what Mr. Fourline is saying is we have to bring people to the table. We have to let people of different views have a seat at the table. This is not illegitimate. Here's an example I would give. In the world of science, there are certain spheres of that world where if you're not a Darwinian evolutionist, you don't have a seat at the table, which may mean that if you're an ID guy, if you're an intelligent design guy, you're not invited to the party. If you're a young earth guy, you're not invited to the party. Now, that's like private sector stuff, but it's an analogy that I'm drawing to illustrate the point.
It's still real, though, right?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely real. It's definitely real. People in small towns, local school boards, what Fourline is saying, should your Christianity be silenced just because you put on your local school board, commissioner hat? He would say no. Now, how you negotiate and navigate these tensions, that becomes the whole issue. But his point is it shouldn't be this way. It shouldn't be this way. Something that I would say, you mentioned how do we draw the line between that and then go, therefore, make disciples. Definitely. We need to be making disciples. We need to be evangelizing people. But you look at the example of Paul, all kinds of people had a seat at the table, at the proverbial table, to discuss the issues of the day. He'd go to the synagogue, but then he would go to the public meeting place. And he would talk about Epicurean philosophy. He would talk with Epicurean philosophers. And he'd talk about this altar to the unknown God. So Paul, in his evangelism, you can't evangelize if you don't understand where people are coming from. You can't persuade people if you don't know where people are coming from. And something that I'll say, this is me, not Mr. Fourline's, but an example of this kind of thing. If you're looking at politics and you've got a spectrum, you've got, say, the extreme right, and you've got, say, the extreme left. But then you got people who are on the right and the left, but they're more reasonable. So there are examples of people on the right and the left who have these long form interviews with people who are very different than them, but they're not trying to cancel them just because they disagree. Like, they're quite a fan of working through ideas with another person, even though they disagree strongly. I think this is an example of the type of accommodationism that Mr. Fourline's is advocating for, except he's advocating for it. It's more than just, podcast conversations. It's a legal accommodation. Right now, we don't actually have legal accommodation. Right now, we have legal strict separation, because those cases have not been overturned. But Mr. Fourline would say that's bad law. It's based on a faulty reading of Jefferson. And by the way, seeing the things in the last couple of years that have been overturned by the Supreme Court that had been based on bad law, it's not altogether discouraging.
Well, I am so intrigued by this conversation and the many implications that come from it. One of the implications in light of what you're sharing, Matt, that stands out from Four Lines when he's talking about education. I'm going to share with our listener a quote from the book. This comes from page 211, and this is one of my favorite statements in the entire book, even though there are many others I can choose. Four Lines says, "The government should remove the muzzle from those who would like to give voice to Christian belief and morality. A professor who is a Christian should be able to acknowledge that he or she is a Christian. In fact, all professors should be able to acknowledge their views of life and the world."
Indeed. I think that's great. I think that's great. Do you mind if I ask you guys a question? You can add something, you know, Mr. Campbell. But Mr. Walters, you read this book. And one of the, you made a remark to me that it was much more accessible than you would have thought. So at one time, you said that to me. And so I can imagine if I'm somebody who's not been to law school, or maybe I just kind of follow politics, you know, cursorily, but not really in depth, I might think this book is out of my league. I'm not going to be able to understand it. But that's not quite true. Would you say that?
The accessibility comment that I found, you know, I am an Alabama native. I answered the call to ministry at a young age and have been in mostly conservative places, even though I've lived in other places that were not as conservative. I lived in New Orleans and I've lived in Louisville. But what I found in this book about accessibility particularly was that Four Lines made concepts that as a person who's trained as a preacher, I really didn't know, even though I've had American history and even though, you know, I've gone through those core curriculum requirements, these were not areas that had previously engaged my mind and my heart. And that's the part that I want to bring out about Four Lines. What he says about Jeffersonian politics engaged not only my mind and actually invited me to go look at some of these sources like the University of Virginia documents and so on, but my heart, because these things matter deeply. They matter personally. They impact our mind, our heart, and our will. And so my comment about the accessibility was, I believe anyone who picks this book up will find the same to be true, that this is not just a book for college students or pastors or politicians. But I think that your senior adult Bible study in your church would even understand what Four Lines is getting at. And I admire Four Lines' ability to communicate on a real, personal, and practical level for all people.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah, I think that even the portions of the book that I've read, because I haven't read it as extensively as Dustin has, but I think one of the things that is so important to understand about the accessibility of this book is that is just how Four Lindsay in this book is. And I know, like, yeah, he wrote it, but Four Lines really did believe that theology, politics, culture, that thinking is a good thing, and that people are thinking beings, that we do. Yes, he believes in the total personality, that we feel and we act, but at the basic nature of who a person is they have a mind. God has created us with a mind to think, and to think well, and to think rationally about these things. And I think that's one of the comments I made earlier, was just how renaissance of a scholar Four Lines is, to be able to do theology for the first 50 years of his academic career, and then all of a sudden go, hey, I think I'd like to write a book on secularism and the American Republic. You know, I mean, he's a mind in a league of his own in this regard. And so I think that there's so much beneficial, a beneficial nature to this book, in that this can be helpful for people who don't really have an interest in, say, constitutional law or politics, but they have an interest in how then should we live in America. How do we have conversations about this? I'm just personally, I'm one of these people that if I don't know something about something, I'm really not going to talk much about it because I don't want to sound stupid. but this book helps us to do that. It helps us to, it gives us a perspective from a Reformed Arminian perspective, even just from an Evangelical Orthodox Christian perspective, of how to approach being salt and light in a dark world. And so I think this is a helpful book for that. Mr. Bracey, any concluding thoughts before we wrap up here?
If anyone has any questions about the book more generally, if you want to continue this conversation, I invite people to reach out to me. My email address is mbracey@welch.edu. And I really appreciate you guys and the engagement and the conversation. It's been really great.
And just for our listeners to know, any of these books that Welch Press is putting out, I am so thankful for what Welch Press is doing and how they are intentionally trying to cultivate the life of the mind, not only their students, but extending that broader to their constituency. And I want to point our listeners to the website before Matt shares some other thoughts before we wrap up here. Just if you actually type in welchpress.com, it redirects to the link where you can find all the books that Welch Press has published. And you can even sign up for emails, if I remember correctly, Matt, where you can actually get an alert saying that Welch Press has got a new book out or something. I believe there's a email subscribe button on the website. Maybe I'm incorrect on that. But anyway, welchpress.com. Hope you guys will check that out.
That's what I was going to mention. And then also Amazon, of course.
Yes. And we appreciate so much, Matt, your time coming on today. And dear listener, we hope you will get a copy of Secularism and the American Republic, Revisiting Thomas Jefferson on Church and State. And as you prepare your church for another election season, we still have several months before that begins, but this will be a great resource to kind of guide your people through on how they should think about the state and the church. We pray these truths have reached you for your good and for God's glory. Until next time, thanks for listening to the Everyday Theology Podcast.